Okay, welcome in everybody to episode 7 of the Beast Lore Podcast, a podcast about cryptid creatures, monsters, and the things that may or may not be hiding in the shadows. I'm your host, Jack Daly. Today we are going to be taking a trip through history to Mesopotamia, Egypt, Greece, Rome, China, Ireland, Mesoamerica, and the modern US to learn about the history of ghosts. I'll be surveying these lands to give you an idea of the beliefs about ghosts and the afterlife, and you'll probably come to see that these disparate lands are more similar than different in their beliefs, and that these specters have been haunting humans since time immemorial. As always, I'll try and provide some theories for why these beliefs exist, so sit back, grab some hot chocolate, and get ready for another great episode of Beast Lore. So for ghosts, I've actually had some experience myself with these creatures, with these beings. I don't really like to talk about this too much, and going on the air to talk about this kind of freaks me out, but I kind of grew up in a haunted house myself. There was just something kind of off about the place I lived. I'm from Evergreen, Colorado, a small mountain town, and I kind of lived in the woods a little bit. And I think that most people that came through to my house could tell that there is something just off about it, that there wasn't something quite right. And really, I think the basement was the epicenter of this kind of paranormal activity and this feeling that sort of permeated my house and that existed there. And honestly, I don't think it was good. I don't think this was a benevolent spirit. Or, you know, I don't know if it was a ghost or if it was a spirit or, you know, what it was, but there was something in that house. And I never actually saw anything physical there, but the house just kind of had a wicked presence. And my family lived there from when I was 8 years old to just a couple of years ago when I was 24 years old is when finally we moved out of the house. I have no idea how we stayed there for so long. I never liked the place, but I'm just thankful that I never have to go back there again. And so I did have some experiences there that I thought I would talk about. One was basically everybody was gone. This was several years ago. I was the only person at the house. Now, we had two dogs there, but I had put them both like in their dog room where they slept. And it was the middle of the night. I had finally, you know, gathered kind of the courage to try and go to sleep. And this is what was when I was in my 20s. So I was still very afraid to be alone in that house. And I literally had just set my head down to try and go to sleep. And I heard these footsteps. Very distinct footsteps. It wasn't a creak. They were footsteps that sounded like someone was wearing boots, almost, walking across the wood floorboards in the top floor of my house, and it was coming straight to my room, and these steps stopped right outside of my door, and it seemed as though whatever it was just standing right outside of there, and I mean, even talking about it right now, it gives me chills, and I don't like reliving this memory, but I mean, it freaked me out, and I went to the door and opened it fully expecting literally a person to be there, and there's nothing there. And I rushed downstairs to see where the dogs were, and they were in their room. They were where they were supposed to be. They didn't get out somehow. It wasn't dogs. But, I mean, at that point, man, I felt violated, honestly. I felt like something had intruded on my personal space. You know, I mean, you're so vulnerable when you're sleeping, and, I mean, I felt really uncomfortable, and I didn't like that experience. And so, a couple of years ago, when we decided to move out of the house, basically, the doors of the house started just slamming hard. I mean, it could have been possibly wind, but, I mean, every door in the house, especially upstairs, would just slam shut. and you'd be sitting there, and all of a sudden, just the door would slam, and it would startle you. And it, I feel like, you know, whatever was there knew that we were moving out, and it just wanted to make one last show. And really, our entrance into that house wasn't greeted too kindly. There, the basement flooded almost immediately, I think, when we moved in. One year, the basement flooded on Christmas Eve, and we had to have somebody come out to take care of it that night, and it basically ruined Christmas. And, I mean, you could obviously just say that that was something natural, but if you've been to the basement of that old house, you would know that there was something unnatural about it. There was something going on there. Also, my mom said that one time she was taking a nap in the basement, and she says that something crept up behind her and whispered her name into her ear. And, I mean, I totally believe that. Like, I don't know what it was, what happened, but there is something in the house. There is an evil presence. And I think that kind of for me, you know, growing up in a place where that sort of energy existed, I mean, that's what's kind of opened me up to the other side, so to speak, you know, that other plane of existence that I've so often talked about, because it was something that I dealt with on a pretty regular basis. You know, it was something was going on in my house, and this house that we lived in, it was built in the 70s, and I mean, I don't think that there was any murders or crimes or anything too dreadful that happened there as far as I know. But I know that the people that lived there before us, they operated some kind of, like, computer business out of their house. So one of the theories that I've had is that possibly they may have conjured some kind of poltergeist, some kind of electromagnetic spirit, possibly. And, you know, I'm just glad that I never have to go back there, and there's definitely something off about it. And one time, I actually did kind of have a ghost sighting. I'm still not sure what to make of this. But basically what happened was, my dad and I were driving home to this old house, and it was a very foggy day. It was late in the evening, probably about 6 or 7 o'clock, just about dinner time during the summer. And Colorado can get quite foggy, especially after, you know, thunderstorms and rainstorms. And it was one of those evenings. And we pulled up to the street. We were just about to turn into the house. But then this wisp was traveling across the road. And it had almost like a human form to it. And granted, there was fog all around, but there was something just different about this wisp. And my dad stopped in the middle of the road, and we kind of just watched it. We were transfixed by it. And we weren't saying anything while it was happening. We were just watching it just sort of travel before our eyes. And it traveled like no fog that I've ever seen or missed or anything. And after it was gone, my dad and I kind of just turned to each other and were like, "Did you see that? Was there something weird about that?" And we both were like, "Dude, I think that was a ghost. Like that there was something different about that." So, you know, I don't know if that was a ghost or not, or if it was just a wisp of fog. I mean, I think that the most logical thing would be to assume that it was fog, but it's hard to explain. It didn't seem like anything else I've ever seen. So that was kind of a weird experience. But anyway, today on the podcast, I'm going to be kind of doing a little bit of what I often do. And I'm still kind of getting a feel for how I like to sort of organize these episodes. But I'm going to give you a rundown of the history of, basically, I'm going to go geographically throughout history and give you some of the beliefs of different cultures about ghosts, which is something that I often do. I'll go over some kind of theories that people have kind of put forth to explain ghosts. I don't really have any historical sightings that I'm going to go over. Maybe I'll throw a couple in here and there. But instead of starting with the history, today I'm going to start with some of the theories that have been put forth. So one thing I want to talk about is this theory of metempsychosis. Okay, and so metempsychosis comes from Pythagoras, who Pythagoras, of course, is famous for the Pythagorean theorem, which, Pythagoras didn't create that himself. The monuments of the Egyptians have shown mastery over quite a bit of the Pythagorean mathematics, and Pythagoras himself was from an island in Greece, I think it was Samos, and he basically traveled throughout that part of the world and gained knowledge from everybody he could, and he ended up starting his Pythagorean school. I can't exactly remember what the name of it is right now, but it was basically for people to learn advanced math and geometry and metaphysics almost, and it was famous for having a plaque over the entrance that said, I think it was something along the lines of, anyone ignorant of geometry can't enter here, something like that. So Pythagoras was sort of a what you could say is an exposer, I guess, of sacred knowledge of the ancient world. But anyway, metempsychosis is a theory of the soul that is derived from the teachings of Pythagoras, and he may have based his ideas on the Indian concept of reincarnation. And in metempsychosis, the soul is immortal and passes through cycles of incarnation in birth and release from the body at death. The behavior of the individual during a particular life can determine the form the soul takes in the next life. And in Plato's Phaedrus, Plato develops this theory of the immortal soul, and he argues that after the death of the body, the soul passes through the realm of the ideas, which is why it is possible for us to possess particular kinds of knowledge, such as the consciousness of virtue and perfection through what he calls the process of anamnesis, or recollection. So I think that the theory of metempsychosis is a good place to jump off on for when we're talking about ghosts, because it's basically the discussions about ghosts focus in on basically metaphysical issues of what happens in the afterlife and what the soul is, you know, where do you go once you die, and what does your actions during life, what does it say about the afterlife and what you're destined to go towards. So, but that's basically what it is. It's the transmigration of souls is essentially what metempsychosis is, and we can see that theory being developed further on in the later Greek philosophy of Plato. So here are some theories that have been put forth to explain what ghosts are. A man named Michael Persinger has put forth a theory that ghosts are caused by electromagnetic fields, and he has shown that pulses in electromagnetic fields cause unusual activity in the brain's temporal lobes. And so basically, if you're in an area with a higher electromagnetic charge, it can interact with your brain and cause you to perhaps see a ghost, or for you to sort of have this experience in your brain. So there's one theory. Another is that infrasound is to be explained for why ghosts exist, and it's been shown that if you're interacting with particular frequencies of infrasound, that you can get chills and feelings of dread that have been associated with ghosts. And then another theory is that mold is actually to blame for experiencing ghosts. There's a man named Shane Rogers, who is an engineering professor at Clarkson University, and he's shown that molds on paranormal locations cause effects such as irrational fear and dementia. So, you know, it's oftentimes there'll be like this creepy old place that's been abandoned and it's said to be, you know, haunted by ghosts. But according to this man, Shane Rogers, a particular type of mold could be the cause of that. And then another thing is carbon monoxide poisoning. In 1921, an individual named Dr. W.H. Wilmer published an article in which he detailed a family who were having weird experiences. They were seeing furniture move, they're hearing strange voices, and they're feeling the presence of invisible specters. And he basically showed that carbon monoxide was the thing that was causing these oral and visual hallucinations. And then the University of London in 2014 did an experiment where basically they showed that if one person has an account of an event happening, it can influence another's memory. So that theory basically posits that someone else said it was real, therefore you are more likely to be influenced by their memory. And those were by a team of psychologists. And then another one is that we just want to believe. Belief in the afterlife and death is comforting, but so we kind of, you know, maybe we create these things to explain, okay, our ancestors, our loved ones are actually going to be in a plane of existence where we can contact them once they die. And that's, you know, something that goes on in a lot of religions and stuff like that as well. But those are basically just some theories I've been put forth to explain the belief in ghosts, or sorry, to basically just explain the theories. And so here's some more, actually, just kind of basically reasons why people might think that ghosts exist. So one thing is possibly that ghosts are projections in the simulation of reality, and after all, reality is pretty much just an illusion that the mind tells you is real. So there may be just something that comes from another dimension and or other realm of existence and exists as a thought form or something like that. Ghosts will haunt people in places for many reasons. Oftentimes they have messages they wish to convey before they move on to a higher realm or back to the creational source. The messages that they have may concern the circumstances surrounding their deaths, such as murders, suicides, accidents, or other foul play. Oftentimes, ghosts have unfinished businesses. Maybe it's an inheritance or a will, or finding a lost paper and other items that belong to the ghosts. And it's said that many ghosts do not realize that they are actually dead. If their death was instantaneous rather than from a prolonged illness, they might not even realize that they're dead. Many ghosts choose to live close to the family that they are a part of when they are in a physical body. Some ghosts like to remain in the physical frequency of the home in which they once lived. And as in all things, ghosts are sometimes positive while some are sometimes negative energy. And a manifested ghost can be seen by one or more people at the same time, but there are instances where only one person in a room can see the ghost while other people see nothing. And basically it's said that these spirits exist in higher frequency realms. So those are just some theories, some background to beliefs in ghosts. But now let's really take a deep dive into the history and do this kind of geographical sweep of the belief in ghosts. So we're going to start in Mesopotamia, which is widely accepted as the cradle of civilization, basically the oldest known civilization that we have, which, I mean, that's being debated, especially with places like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which is, archaeologists are turning up that that's actually probably twice as old as Mesopotamia, which changes all of our understanding of history. But anyway, we're going to start in Mesopotamia one way or another, and especially with the Assyrians. and they had a belief in ghosts, and they called them Gidim or Etemu. And those are the words for ghosts that lived in the underworld. And the Mesopotamian underworld was a dreary place. There was little food or water. And if relatives did not provide food and water at funerary offerings, they would be condemned to an eternity of thirst. If a deceased person had not been buried properly, or if there is an injustice or unnatural circumstances behind their death, they were allowed to come back as ghosts. And once everything was set straight, the ghosts would return. But if they weren't, the ghosts were then vengeful spirits. They would come back to haunt friends, relatives, or acquaintances. And they could present themselves through an apparition or a possession. So they could be a physical thing that you would see. Or they could actually possess the person. And to get rid of the ghost, an individual would have to right the wrong that they committed. And the Mesopotamians had doctors who were trained to perform exorcisms. And the exorcisms often involved magic rituals, incantations, and invocations of deities such as Shamash. And Shamash was the sun god and the god of justice. And so there was an association with the sun going down. And that's when kind of, you know, the spirit world opened itself up, was at night. And Shamash was supposed to kind of rectify that and also act as the god of justice. And it was also said that ghosts would return for no real reason. And in that case, an exorcism was performed and the ghosts would be bereft of any offerings that were left. So we kind of see here with some of these ghost beliefs something that's kind of similar with the vampire. You know, they would come back to the close friends and relatives. If you didn't bury them properly, there would be, retribution for it, similar to the vampire, right? So that kind of points to these, kind of preternatural beliefs about honoring the dead and providing them with, the right things to go into the afterlife. And this Mesopotamian underworld is kind of set an example for these other places that we're going to go to, because oftentimes the afterlife is a kind of bleak place. We'll see that in certain realms of the Greek afterworld, especially Tartarus, and in the Mesopotamian Xibalba, which is from the Mayans. And so we see here kind of these, you know, almost the fear of the afterlife, or the uncertainty of what's going to happen, and sort of taking the precautions to make sure that those kind of those bad things won't come to exist. And I also want to mention that, you know, ghosts are another example of anthropomorphism and anthropomorphic beliefs when it comes to cryptozoology. And I mean, these ones are actually supposed to be humans themselves, but once again, we're kind of projecting our own image into different realms of the universe, which definitely seems like an inherent human tendency. Okay, so also, ghosts are in the Bible, you know, and I've said before, I'm not a Christian. I mean, I grew up Catholic. I have a pretty good familiarity with the Bible, but I always think it's funny when people, Bible thumpers who don't really know what they're talking about, are afraid of magic and ghosts and the occult or the paranormal. But that kind of stuff is all over the Bible. So one of the most famous ghost stories from the Bible comes when Saul goes to talk to Samuel's ghosts. And this is in, I think it's Samuel 24. And I'm going to have to double check on that. But anyway, when Samuel dies, he is buried in Ramah. And Saul, who is now the king of Israel, seeks wisdom from God to choose a course of action against the forces of the Philistines. He doesn't receive any answers from dreams, from prophets, or from Urim and Thummim, which are stones that are attached to the Hashin, which is the breastplate worn by the high priest, and they're used for divination. And so Saul searches for a witch in disguise, even though he's kind of gotten rid of all of the witches and the necromancers in the area. And eventually he is led to the Witch of Endor, who says that she can speak with Samuel. And she conjures Samuel, and this ghost berates Saul for disobeying God. And then he predicts that Samuel will perish in battle the next day, and he ends up perishing. So, I mean, here we go again. There's witches and ghosts and divination and all that stuff right there in the Old Testament. And that was actually from 1 Samuel 28. So you can go ahead and look up that if you would like to. And then also there's ghosts in the New Testament. And so in Luke 24:39, Jesus has come back. He's been resurrected. And he has to convince his disciples that he is not a ghost. He says, "Look at my hands and my feet. It is I myself. Touch me and see me. Or touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have." So, according to Christian belief, according to Jesus himself, there are ghosts, and he has to convince his disciples that he isn't one. Okay, so now let's go to ancient Greece. So, in ancient Greek belief, when you die, a coin is placed in your mouth to pay Charon, who is the ferryman who takes you across the river Styx. Once the soul is on the other side of the river, you pass by the three-headed dog Cerberus, and then stand to be judged by the three judges and give an account of your life. And after the judges have conferred, one is given a cup of water from the river Lethe, and you would forget your past life. And that's another thing that we'll see is quite prevalent, is basically you drinking something or eating something when you're going to the afterlife, and that's what causes you to forget your past life. And this also indicates the presence of metempsychosis, because you probably would be reincarnated, and that's why you can't remember your past life. And so there's three realms that you could go to. You could go to the Elysian Fields, which is where great people and people who died in war went to. Good people went to the plains of Asphodel, and bad people went to Tartarus. And so that's kind of like the heaven, purgatory, hell layout of Christianity. And there are actually ghosts in the Iliad and the Odyssey. And so in the Iliad, Achilles is berated by the ghost of his slain friend Patroclus for failing to properly tend to his corpse. And he was thereby prevented from entering the land of the dead. So once again, we see if you don't take care of the corpse properly in ancient Greece, then you might have a ghost on your hands, just like in Mesopotamia. And then in the Odyssey, Homer depicts the underworld, Hades, which is a cold subterranean place where spirits of the dead wander in the fields of Asphodel, and a tasteless weed serves as their only food. And in Book 11 of the Odyssey, which is sometimes called the Book of the Dead, Homer introduces two uses of ghosts, which are as suppliers of information and as chroniclers of the afterlife. And Odysseus summons an array of ghosts and singles out the Theban soothsayer Tiresias, who gives him information about how to get back to the island of Ithaca. And then he also speaks to his mother, who informs him of how the underworld works. And he also speaks to the ghost of his crew member, Elpenor, who died in a fall from Circe's rooftop. And he also demands a proper burial and threatens retribution if he doesn't get it. And so, once again, we have this, sort of fear of what will happen if you don't receive the proper burial. And ancient Egypt also had belief in ghosts. And, I mean, of course, you know, mummies are very, very famous from Egypt. So they had complicated, beliefs in the afterlife. if you want to take a look at, you know, some of their actually beliefs, there's a thing called the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and it's basically magical spells that will lead an individual through the Duat, which is what they basically called the afterlife, the afterworld. And there's also the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is another thing that is basically a list of the preparations that one has to go through to ensure a safe passage in the afterlife. I'm not really going to go into Tibetan beliefs, but Tibetan Book of the Dead, Egyptian Book of the Dead, and then Book 11 of the Odyssey, which is also called the Book of the Dead. Or was that the Odyssey or the Iliad? Oh yeah, that was the Odyssey. Okay, so anyway, the Egyptians had a place called the Field of Reeds that they believed in, and it was a place where no suffering existed, and if you made it there, you would find all you lost in death. And it's a place that the gods created, and it was a perfect place where a person would go to after they had passed through the death and judgment by Osiris. And you can see on, you know, Egyptian iconography that basically you would be, your heart would be weighed against the feather of Mat on the scales of balance. And if it was shown that your heart was lighter than the feather, then you would get to move on to the Field of Reeds. And they had the concept of disembodied spirits, basically. And they also had this concept of Mat, which is about harmony and balance, which kind of ruled everything in the Egyptian sort of existence. And a proper burial was absolutely necessary. And if there was an appearance of a ghost, this would indicate a disturbance in the natural order of things. And it was most commonly associated with a dissatisfaction with the body's burial. Once again, that is coming up. And the soul was believed to be the Ku, which was the immortal aspect of the person. And there's actually a pretty famous ghost story from Egypt. It's called Khonsum Hob and the Ghost. It comes from the Ramessid period of the New Kingdom, which was between 1186 and 1077 BC. And in this tale, the high priest of Amun, Khonsum Hob, encounters a spirit named Nebusemek, whose tomb had fallen into ruin. And Nebusemek is depicted as an individual with a problem, not as a ghost who has returned to haunt or trouble the living, but either way, it's a disembodied spirit. So there we have ancient Egypt. And also now we're going to turn to Rome. I probably should have gone there after Greece, but I had that order in my notes, so that's what we're going with. But the Romans had a tradition of ghost stories in their dramas, such as Plautus's Mostellaria, which means the haunted house. And some of their beliefs are that ghosts of murdered people would appear in a room lit by a torch, since ghosts could not be seen without some kind of light. They would not appear in a dream unless it was a friend or a loved one. An improper burial was the main reason for a spirit to return from the afterlife, once again. And the Aeneid also has a sort of descent into the underworld portion, similar to the Odyssey. And so, you know, just to give you a quick little overview of these ancient epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey were written by Homer. The Iliad is about a great war that was fought between the Greeks and the Trojans, and the Greeks won that. That was the Trojan War. And then the Odyssey is about Odysseus and his travels back to the island of Ithaca. Odysseus was one of the greatest Greeks. And then, you know, years later, the Aeneid was written, and that was by Virgil. And basically, the Aeneid chronicles the journey of Aeneas, who was one of the greatest Trojan fighters, and basically what happened to him after the Trojan War was fought. And so Aeneas had to flee from Troy, And basically what happens is, you know, the Trojan ancestors end up settling Rome, according to this story. Romulus and Remus came from that line and established Rome. So it's kind of just like an epic of Rome that I think it was actually, you know, paid for by whoever the Caesar was at that time to sort of boost, you know, I guess pride in being a Roman. And so basically that's what that story is. And in the Aeneid, Aeneas goes to the underworld with the ferryman Charon, who he takes the spirits of the dead across the river Acheron. And Aeneas sees that there's some people on the banks of the river, and the Sibyl that he is with explains that these are souls of the dead who have not received proper burial. And then Aeneas gets through because the Sibyl gives Charon a golden branch. So that's how he gets into the underworld, even though he was still alive. And he sees that there are souls lined up before Minos awaiting judgment. So again, we have this, you know, judgment of the dead. And Aeneas sees Dido, which was one of his former lovers. And Greeks that are in there flee at the sight of him. And he sees casualties from the Trojan War. And then they pass through a fortress where Rhadamanthus is giving judgments to sinners, and tortures are being carried out there. And then Aeneas sees his father, Anchises, in the fields of gladness. And Anchises answers his questions, similar to Odysseus and his mother. And then Anchises tells him that the descendants of the Trojans will found Rome, and that a Caesar will come from the line of Ascanius. So we have both of those kind of Homeric plot points of the ghost being suppliers of information and chroniclers of the afterlife. But in the case of Anchises, he also has the foresight and the ability to see the future. Okay, so China also has beliefs in ghosts that go back quite a while. They say that a spirit of a person who has drowned, who has died alone in battle, or went unburied might be become a ghost, and that they can only be seen at night by torchlight. And so that's kind of similar to some of the beliefs that we've seen earlier. They also think that spirits of ancestors who wish to relate them information would appear in a dream. So again, we have dream ancestors being a part of seeing ghosts. And these beliefs were heavily informed by the ancestor worship that they had, and the belief that the departed continue to have an influence on people's lives. They have a ghost festival that's on the 15th day of the 7th month, and this is known as Ghost Month, where the realm of the living and the dead is at its thinnest. And that is very similar to the Celtic Samhain or the Mesoamerican Dia de los Muertos, which we'll learn more about here in a little bit. And the Chinese afterlife was thought of as a journey in which the soul had to cross a bridge into the abyss where they were eventually judged. And they would drink a brew called Mengpo soup, which would cause them to forget their life. And so that's similar to, again, some of the beliefs that we've seen earlier. And there's Mesoamerican beliefs in the ghosts in the afterlife as well that are pretty complex. And the Maya believed that lingering ghosts had to be kept away by the use of charms or amulets, and that they could be driven back to the underworld by a shaman. And then the Mayan underworld, called Xibalba, was a place where there were lords of the dead that could trick the soul of the deceased as it made the way to paradise. And they've actually been uncovering that Xibalba is a place that they kind of believe to be in sinkholes, and there's also places that are underneath some of the pyramids. I believe it's the Pyramid of the Feathered Serpent has an entire layout of Xibalba underneath there, and which is pretty fascinating. And you know, the Mayans, they set up basically their whole their whole layout based on these sinkholes, which are basically underwater or underground water repositories, and they came to associate them with sinkholes. And if you see people on like these television programs that go into the sinkholes, you can understand why they would be such a place of fascination, because they are incredibly dark and dank and really scary. And that's kind of like some of these other places that we've learned about. And so maybe that would be an interesting thing if archaeologically they can uncover that, for example, the Mesoamericans and their belief in the underworld was informed by a physical location like Xibalba is associated with these sinkholes. But anyway, there was a spirit dog named Zolotl who would guide the spirit through the underworld, and it would help you to avoid trips and traps that the lords of Xibalba were setting up until the individual reached the Tree of Life, which they could climb up and go to paradise. And so Zolotl here is acting as what is called a psychopomp, which is similar to who Charon is. And a psychopomp is basically somebody who leads you into the underworld. And souls were not supposed to return unless they appeared as friends or relatives in dreams. But they also thought that the dead could also come back in plant form, which that is not something that I found in any other culture. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And then the Aztecs, they had spirits that were known as Chihuahua Teo. And this was a ghost of a woman who died in childbirth. And it would strike women down and steal their children. It would slip into homes and abduct children. And you could use amulets and charms to ward them off. And so there's again, you know, protective magic, and the use of amulets and charms is very important for dealing with ghosts, just like it is with vampires or werewolves. And they thought that these spirits were bringers of bad news, or that they were omens of doom. And they also thought that dogs could see them and that they would protect them from ghosts. Okay, so also I want to talk about the Celts a little bit, because the Celts had an interesting belief system in the afterlife and of ghosts. So they believed that time was cyclical and not linear. And they have a celebration called Samhain, which is the end of the yearly cycle that they called the Wheel of the Year. And a lot of these, the pagan civilizations or pagan societies of Europe had this cyclical, conception of time. And the Celtic Wheel of the Year is almost identical to the Slavic Wheel of the Year. And Samhain is the time when the veil between this world and the next is the thinnest, and this corresponds with what is now called All Hallows Eve or All Saints Day, Halloween. And you know, if you don't know about this by now, basically all of these, you know, modern holidays are just a result of the Catholic Church and Christianity sort of eradicating the pagan societies that existed before them, and they basically just ripped off the pagans' belief systems so that they could get people to shift over to Christianity. So if you think that Christmas is something new, you're mistaken. Easter isn't a Christian holiday. Christmas isn't a Christian holiday. Halloween is obviously a pagan holiday, but they tried to make it Christian. You can go on and basically look at the Wheel of the Year and then compare them to these Christian holidays, and it's obvious that the Christians just, kind of rode over this proud pagan tradition. And, I mean, obviously, if you can't tell, I'm very sympathetic to the pagans, and I'm kind of in disbelief sometimes that Christian people don't understand that this is what happened. And people would prepare meals for basically these souls of the dead, and they were basically restless spirits, but they're also free to roam. roam around, and the Celts would make masks so that the spirits that were mad wouldn't be able to recognize them. So that's kind of where our costume tradition of Halloween comes from. And I also want to talk about Renaissance magic and the Renaissance belief in ghosts, Renaissance and kind of early modern. So at that time, there was a renewed interest in magic, as well as the occult and in necromancy. And so necromancy basically has come to be understood as summoning the dead, but the word actually means divination by the dead. And I am a huge fan of Shakespeare and Shakespeare's plays. And there's two very famous plays that deal with ghosts, which are Hamlet and Macbeth. And so in Hamlet, King Hamlet's ghosts come back to inform his son that his death was unnatural. And what happened is that King Hamlet was in fact killed by his brother Claudius, who went on to marry the queen, Gertrude, who was King Hamlet's wife. And then Hamlet basically has to determine whether or not the ghost is telling the truth and is actually the ghost of his father, or if it's like some kind of evil spirit trying to deceive him. And it's also unclear which part of the afterlife the ghost is in, but it seems that it is in purgatory. So I want to read you off basically a little section of the play in which the ghost of King Hamlet is talking to Hamlet. And he's basically saying, okay, you know, I'm the ghost and I basically had this unnatural death. And I think it's Act 1, Scene 5 that this comes in. So the ghost of King Hamlet says, "I am thy father's spirit, doomed for a certain term to walk the night, and for the day confined to fast and fires, till the foul crimes done in my days of nature are burnt and purged away. But that I am forbid to tell the secrets of my prison house, I could a tale unfold whose lightest word would harrow up thy soul, freeze thy young blood, make thy two eyes like stars start from their spheres, thy knotted and combined locks to part, and each particular hair to stand on end, like quills upon the fearful porpentine. But this eternal blazon must not be to ears of flesh and blood. List, list, O list, if thou didst ever thy dear father love." So basically that's just, he says that he's a spirit and he's doomed to, you know, walk the earth at night, but then during the day he's confined in fires. And so actually in this scene you can see beliefs in hell and purgatory being put forth, but he's basically saying that he can't say the secrets straight up because of his confinement in the prison house. And later on he says that you know, he's been the victim of a murder most foul and of unnatural deeds, and that basically I think he says that the queen was quick to take to incestuous sheets, but he's basically saying I was killed by my brother and she and the queen conspired to kill me and to get married afterwards. But if you've never read Hamlet, I don't know what you're waiting for. Definitely read Hamlet. It's probably the greatest thing that a human being has ever written, in my opinion. I've read it probably 5 times, and each time I get about 100 new things. It's got the best language of anything ever written. So read Hamlet, but the whole thing is based upon essentially King Hamlet's ghost. And then also in Macbeth, there's quite a poignant ghost scene in there. And so if you don't know, Macbeth is about this character, Macbeth's ascent to the throne, and about his downfall. And basically Macbeth is spurred on by these three witches to, you know, commit some murders and eventually become what was called the Thane of Cawdor. And so Macbeth kills Duncan, who is the Thane of Cawdor, and then And Macbeth was Duncan's captain, and then he takes the throne. But then Macbeth also kills Banquo, who is his noble friend, and he did that essentially out of fear. And then there's a scene where they're sitting around a dinner table. It's Macbeth, Lady Macbeth, and some other of their kind of royal friends, I believe. And then Macbeth sees Banquo's ghost and is terrified, and he just kind of starts going crazy. So I'm going to read off a quote from that as well. And Macbeth says, Blood hath been shed here now. In the olden time, ere human statue purged the gentle wheel. Ay, and since too, murders have been performed, too terrible for the ear. The time has been that, when the brains were out, the man would die, and there an end. But now they rise again, with 20 mortal murders on their crowns, and push us from our stools. This is more strange than such a murder is. So he's basically saying, you know, as strange as the murders that I've committed are, me seeing this ghost is even more strange. And Macbeth is my second favorite Shakespeare play. It's possibly has the most rememberable quotes in it. I would say Hamlet is the most, has the best language, but Macbeth is very quotable. Well, I don't know if I would say quotable. I think that Hamlet is actually more quotable, but Macbeth has these great lines that you can just go back to. Okay, so to round off the show, I'm going to talk about American spiritualism. And spiritualism basically became quite popular in the 1840s, and it lasted for almost a century, I'm pretty sure. It began in the burned-over district of upstate New York, where the Second Great Awakening was emerging. And spiritualism was based on the belief that spirit mediums could contact the spirits of dead people. And they thought that the afterlife was not static and that spirits evolved there. And basically seances were performed to contact the spirits of the dead. So that was kind of like the modern day necromancy, was these seances. And an individual named Emanuel Swedenborg claimed to be in contact with spirits and said that the afterlife was a very complex place. And then also an individual named Franz Mesmer introduced techniques of hypnotism where he said he could induce trances and could create contact with supernatural beings. And it was called mesmerism. And I believe that's where the word mesmerized comes from. But then another interesting little fact is that Mary Todd Lincoln actually organized seances to contact her dead son while they were in the White House. So, you know, there is another kind of occult revival in the American scene, and spiritualism and the you know, desire to come in contact with the ghosts became quite popular. Well, that's all for today's show. You can see now that beliefs in ghosts are complicated and that the beliefs in the afterlife have been present since time immemorial. Make sure to give your loved ones a proper burial and be sure to check your carbon monoxide monitors. Beast Lore is available on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, and wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to follow me on social media at USD Folklore on Twitter and at Archaic Futurism on Instagram. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.